You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find a Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com. I'm joined by Alex Steele here today, who's sitting in for Lisa Abramowitz. Boy, I tell you, it is a good thing to be a healthcare M&A banker. There's always a deal in that space. Today, Pfizer announcing that it is acquiring Array Biopharma for $10.6 billion. To get the latest, we welcome our good friend Sam Fazeli. Sam is the director of European research for Bloomberg Intelligence, but his day job is he's one of the best pharmaceutical and healthcare analysts on the street. He joins us from our London studio. Sam, thanks so much for joining us. Boy, this price tag is just monstrous. Does this make sense to you, this deal that Pfizer's doing?
Thank you, Paul. Yes, and good morning to both of you. Pfizer's balance sheet is pretty strong. The growth profile of the company going past the current patent expiry for Lyrica is, they like it to be stronger than perhaps some of us think it is. We always thought they would do M&A. What the price tag is, a billion here, a billion there, what's that amongst friends, right? but they're buying what I would consider to be one of the preeminent drug developers amongst the biotechs, if you think about the number of drugs that this company is responsible for in terms of what's gone out there and deals they've done. So we calculate about 8.4 times 2023 sales. There's no profits to talk about just yet.
2023 sales.
Yeah, ooh. Yeah. But those are sales that are not the, they have a reasonable probability of actually happening. The products are already on the market and they've got some good data in hand. And in the end, it is at the top end of the range that we've looked at, but it's not the most expensive. That is what it is.
Could be worse. Is what I'm hearing from you, Sam. So to that point, though, I feel like getting on drugs that will, or getting in the patent for drugs that will wind up cutting chemotherapy is going to be super, super hot in the market. Do we expect another company to come in and try and shuffle Pfizer out?
Yeah, I don't think so. This kind of thing doesn't usually happen when you have two managements that have agreed and there's a big price tag out there already. It just doesn't happen. You know, I've never really seen it in biotech, so I'd expect not.
So, Sam, what is so special about Array that would cause Pfizer to step up and pay this price?
So they described three pillars of value, and we basically responded to that already in our React, which is the kind of thing that we've seen. There's a product on the market, or two products on the market, and there's ample opportunity for expanding the reach of those products. And those revenues, it could easily be a billion or plus if they keep expanding it, and Pfizer can because they have very deep pockets. The company has several products that have been licensed to other companies where the potential for royalties are meaningful. And then, of course, they have a bench of scientists who've been creating these drugs, and we don't know exactly what they've got in their preclinical hands in Boulder, Colorado, but there were some hints that Pfizer gave us over the call we just listened to, which makes it sound as if there's other products obviously expected to come along. But they've been a very productive team. So they would not split. Several times they were asked this question. They would not split the value that they've ascribed to each of those three pillars I've just told you.
So how does, explain to me how in the biotech world this works, because normally in a different industry, if you make an acquisition, there's going to be some synergy costs you can get out of it. That's going to be a big thing. And then sort of when it's going to be accretive to earnings, and then how you sort of meld the operations, and will the cultures fit, etc. Is it like a different scenario in a biotech world?
Yeah, I mean, Alex, that's a very good question. At the end of the day here, what you're buying is knowledge and the ability and the long history of these people developing these sort of drugs. Not that Pfizer hasn't got them themselves, but here's a bunch of scientists. They said about 100 scientists, R&D people, based in Colorado. They've said they're going to keep the current structure of Array in place to continue allowing it to be innovative and you know, pump out these drugs, and they go into Pfizer's pipeline as opposed to having to be licensed out because the company is too small to develop everything. So in these cases, it's really not about cost savings.
So Sam, if I'm a Pfizer shareholder, am I concerned, do I read into a transaction like this that, gee, Pfizer doesn't have its own pipeline, maybe its R&D isn't that good or that successful that it forces them to go out and buy products?
Yeah, no, I don't think that's fair. I think it's more about, in the pharmaceutical business, it's all about shots on goal, because once you take that shot, you don't actually know whether it's going to go in or not. So you've got to have a number of opportunities running at the same time to see which one actually comes to fruition. They have a number of drugs that are looking interesting and exciting. And, you know, it's two steps forward, one step back with pharma. So you've got to expand the range that you've got access to, and then make sure that you have the wherewithal to do it, which Pfizer does.
Can I just ask a dumb question here? So, like, literally, is it possible that there's a drug that could reduce the need for chemo? Like, is that real? Because that's amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know what? I was told years ago there's no dumb questions. So
There totally are. Don't lie. Everyone says that's not true. But
and certainly this is not dumb at all, because it's exactly where pharmaceutical industry wants to go and cancer patients want to go. I mean, it's important to realize that there is a little bit of a slogan that's going on there too, because these aren't drugs that are side effect free. It's just they're different to chemo. They may not include, you know, the usual things that chemo has got going with it is the hair loss and the vomiting, and you know, none of these things are nice, right? And you know, blood counts going down, and really feeling fatigued. And who wants to be fatigued when you're trying to get treated, right?
Yeah.
So. But these drugs do have their own side effects. Let's not forget that. And this is a triple combination they're using for colorectal cancer going forward.
Right. Sam Fazeli, thank you so much for breaking down this deal for us. Sam is the Director of Research, European Research for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from the London studio. Well, trade tensions between China and the U.S. continue to simmer, putting even more focus on the G20 meeting coming up later this month. To get the latest on the trade discussions between the U.S. and China, we welcome Leland Miller, CEO of the China Beigebook International, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Leland, thanks so much for being with us. From your perspective, what is the latest with the U.S. and China? Are things kind of off again, on again? Where are we?
I think that nothing has fundamentally changed since President Trump levied the last set of tariffs a number of weeks ago. Now, if you read the headlines, it looks like we're descending into true gloom. The Chinese are preparing for the long fight. President Trump is getting excited about the idea of going big on tariffs into 2020. It's a political winner. Nobody can get along. We're attacking their technology companies. So there's a lot of reasons why people think that this is disintegrating and that a deal's being taken off the table or is already taken. I don't think that's the case. As a matter of fact, I think that if President Xi reengages at G20, which we expect him to do, then the president is prepared to punt full tariffs and restart the talks. And I think that that's actually where we're heading right now.
Why would Xi do that? In that, Trump said, if you don't do this, I'm going to levy tariffs on you. So why would Xi then look like he's caving?
Well, none of this is optimal for Xi Jinping, but you got to look at the downside on this. So right now, they're looking at the potential of there being 25% tariffs on all 500 billion of Chinese imports, in addition to the fact that Huawei, which is arguably the most, if not one of the most important SOEs in China, is on death watch because of what the Commerce Department's been doing to it and what the White House has been doing to it. So right now, none of this is optimal. But it was also not optimal to send Liu He the night that Trump was announcing tariffs, it was a body blow to the Chinese. It looked bad. But at the same time, they're measuring the circumstances as being, you know, what is the best we can get out of this? And the best they can get out of this is get a deal with Trump on trade so that they're not worrying about this for 2020.
So does the what's going on in Hong Kong, does that impact President Xi and how he might be perceiving these negotiations? That's kind of a body blow again, or a black eye to President Xi with what happened in Hong Kong. Is that going to influence the trade discussions, you think?
You know, it might. All of this has to come down to the fact whether Xi can look strong while engaging with President Trump. Now, President Trump could have put out the olive branch to President Xi. Instead, he basically said, if you don't come and meet with me, I'm going to be really mean to you and we're going to crush you. That doesn't make things easy for the Chinese. At the same time, there's a lot of hysterics going on right now. And Xi Jinping has to look at this. You know, how do I not look weak, but at the same time engage enough to get all these irons off the fire so that I can concentrate on the domestic economy? The Chinese economy, under the type of tariff pressure we're talking about, will have a much harder time later this year. And I think President Xi is balancing the pros and cons, making sure he has a consensus in the leadership. But I think that they are inclined to go forward.
See, that's what I don't understand, is that I feel like a lot of the rhetoric is it's so important for both of them, therefore they're going to have to do that. In essence, if Xi accepts the fact that there are going to be tariffs on China no matter what, and that President Trump's going to ramp up the tariffs no matter what, he neutralizes Trump.
Well, I think that in President Xi's mind, if he can get signals from the U.S. side that the tariffs are going to come off in a deal. So, first of all, in order to continue the talks, President Xi would have to get some pledges from President Trump. First is Huawei is part of the deal. Second, that we're going to start peeling these tariffs off and you're not going to put more tariffs on while we continue to talk. So they create a new timeline. This is agonizing for trade and China watchers, but this is the way the things work. And if he can get an understanding that, you know, they were very close before. They were 97% of the way there. This idea that they didn't get most of it finalized is wrong. They're very close. They have to go back to where they were before. And if they do that, then they're very close for President Xi getting a deal that will pull off most, probably not all, but most of the tariffs they have now. No more tariffs, a respite for Huawei, a reprieve for Huawei. These are big things. So these are things that they cannot underestimate and walk away from out of mere pride.
So Leland, just talking about President Xi, how strong is his position in China today?
It has been remarkable that there has been pushback against Xi in the state media, among dissidents. I don't think his position is in any way threatened. But it is remarkable that he is getting flack for his handling of the trade war and handling of the economy. Now, this makes it even more important he doesn't look weak going forward. But I don't think there's a question. While this is not a one-person totalitarian dictatorship of any kind, he is the leader of China. He guides policy. And while he needs to make sure that he is not deeply offending this Politburo Standing Committee, he still runs the show. So this is his show to run in terms of trade. And if he thinks he can negotiate with President Trump, you know, they're best friends after all, then he'll move forward on this.
So John Authors, Bloomberg opinion columnist, writes a lot about Dirk Magnus's book, Red Flags. I don't know if you've read that yet, but he talks about why Xi's China is in jeopardy. And a lot of the conversation surrounding the book is really interesting in that Mao and Deng both had their own models for communist China, but that Xi has a totally different one, and that's going to affect all these kind of trade decisions and arguments. Would you agree in that you can't look back at the last 100 years of China growth and extrapolate that to the next 100? Is that we're in a whole new growth kind of paradigm? Is that true?
I think Xi's challenges are enormous, and he made it much more difficult for himself when he not only named himself, you know, president for life, but mm-hmm. then he ensconced it formally. Like, this could have been the background of everything. Everyone knows Xi's not going anywhere, but he made sure to make a public issue of it. When he did that, he tied his fortunes in very closely with that of the Chinese economy and that of China generally. So that anything bad that happens to the Chinese economy, who do you have to blame? Xi Jinping. If China undergoes problems, who do you have to blame? Xi Jinping. So he has made his life much more difficult. I don't think he's going anywhere. I do think that the pressures on him are going to be immense in the next few years with the economy, even under the best set of circumstances. So this will be tough. And we could emerge from this a few years from now with more of a consensus-based leadership, with Xi still there, but not with as much control, depending on how things end up in the next 18 months.
How How would you characterize the Chinese economy right now? Is it a 6.5% grower or something less than that?
Well, it's not growing at 6.5%. You know, the GDP numbers are always political narratives put into a number. That said, you know, we have data that's coming in right now, and we're going to be announcing it next week. But what I would say is watch very closely to what the Chinese are saying. There's a lot of talk this week from Beijing about how they have all these options in terms of stimulus if they need them. And one of the things that we've made very clear in the past is that when the Chinese are talking a lot about all the options they have, they typically have already started utilizing them.
Okay.
So I think that's where we're going, and we'll be able to talk a little bit more of this in a few days.
Good. We'll have you back for that, because I think that's one of the underpinnings of the negotiations and the assumptions is how strong is China's economy. The stronger it is, presumably, the tougher stance they can take with the U.S.
Well, what I find really interesting, though, and this is going to go to UBS and sort of them using a bond deal over the Chinese pig statement from Paul Donovan, their chief economist, is that we talk different languages.
Yeah.
Like the West and China are just... they talk different languages, they have different priorities, and like that to me is like a whole big rainbow, big cloud as to how the conversation must be going when it comes to trade.
Exactly. Leland Miller, CEO of the China Beige Book International, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down the ongoing trade discussions.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Well, this week is Central Bank Week. We've got the Fed, we've got the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England all meeting, and of course the FOMC, we'll have Fed Chairman Powell speaking on Wednesday, so clearly the markets are focusing on that. To get a sense of what we might expect, we welcome our next guest, Matt Maley, Managing Director and Equity Strategist at Miller Tabak, based in Newton, Massachusetts. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. What do you expect to hear from Fed Chairman Powell this week?
Well, to be honest with you, I think the market's going to be a little disappointed. I think the Fed chairman will be a little less dovish than people are expecting. No less dovish than he has been. There's no question they've made a change to a more dovish tone. But their actions, I just think in the past, especially in the past 10 years, where you know central bank liquidity has been so important to the markets, they haven't acted until we've seen a more significant move both in the economy and in the economic data and in the markets. The Fed's a little bit more market dependent than they admit to. They are very data dependent, but they're also market dependent.
So how is the market actually positioned for this? Because a huge run up in utilities, the valuation's super high, yet they're utilities and defensives for a reason. So like, what's the positioning risk here?
Well, if they do signal a definitive change in their actions, by actually saying that they're going to raise cuts pretty much no matter what in July, that's going to have a lot of people caught off sides. Not only the utility stocks very strong, but consumer staples, another defensive group, has been very strong, and I think the people will start to shift out of that and go into some of the more growthy names, obviously technology, et cetera. When we've seen the semiconductor stocks kind of roll over recently, they could bounce back. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. Again, I'm more cautious than I think a lot of people are. But the thing that really concerns me most is that the stock market is definitely pricing in a Fed move to a much more dovish stance because it's not moving higher due to a better economy or better earnings, as we've seen that a lot of estimates for both economic growth and estimates for the S&P 500 have come down in the last 2 weeks, not move up.
Wouldn't it be amazing if Chair Jay Powell came out and he's like, okay, guys, we're going to cut this many times at this date, and that's what we're going to do. Take care. See you later.
See you later.
And everyone's like,
right.
Great, let's reposition.
Off to the beach. Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, there's no question he won't make it quite that definitive, but if he, you know, they usually tell you, you know, really telegraph it well in advance. So how he portrays how the July meeting is going to go is going to be very important.
So, Matt, if in fact the Fed is not quite as dovish as maybe the market is currently discounting, how do you play it right here?
Well, you know, it's hard. Number one, I do think, like I said, that the with earnings estimates coming down, the consensus earnings estimates, the economy slowing a little bit, I think raising a little bit of cash, and if you want to put more money to work, buy those defensive groups, but buy them on weakness. You look at the overbought condition of the consumer staples, which have been very obviously very strong. They've made new all-time highs. Same with the utilities. But the consumer staples names, I think, are going to be the good ones. But most importantly, if we do get another leg lower, which would not be the worst thing in the world. I mean, you know, we're only down 7%, though. That's a normal and healthy move in any market, much less one that's being involved in a trade war. When you get the kind of downdraft, much like we got in December, now I'm not calling for a 20% decline like we got in the fourth quarter of last year, but you get something down in the correction territory of 10 or 12%, and you've got some money on the sidelines, you can put that to work in your favorite names at really good prices. But if you're prepared in advance, you can take advantage of it. If you don't have that cash on the sidelines, you won't be able to.
How else are you going to hedge? Looking for derivatives or anything along those lines too?
Well, people can certainly do that. The one thing I worry about that is that the VIX is a little high, given how much the market is rallying. So that makes the hedging a little bit more expensive than it was, say a couple of weeks, in April. But you can certainly play, especially in the SPY, the S&P 500 ETF. The options in that market are very, very liquid, and you can get in and out of them very quickly.
Matt Milley, thank you so much. Matt is managing director and equity strategist for Miller Tabak, based up in Massachusetts. Well, the troubles continue at Deutsche Bank. The stock is down over 30% over the past 12 months. Bloomberg News reported this morning that the bank is considering exiting the U.S. equity trading business. To get the latest on all things Deutsche Bank, we turn to Yalman Onaran. Yalman is a senior finance writer for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone. Yalman, thanks so much for joining us. My first question is, when I saw that news about exiting the U.S. equities trading business, is how can an investment bank be a global bank without trading U.S. equities? So what's going on there?
It cannot. You asked the right question. I mean, this is very unusual, and you know, they keep coming up with new restructuring plans, and at the end that none of them work, and they keep coming back to another plan. But it's very radical, yet it's kind of harmful, because you know, if you are an investment bank, as you said, you have to be in equities, and you have to be in the U.S. in equities, because you know, the most IPOs happen here. Other kind of stock-related investment banking deals, even M&A is really connected to the ability to sort of connect with these companies in every way. So it's very unusual. You know, even after the big financial crisis, the European banks that, you know, a lot of them that collapsed, only Royal Bank of Scotland and Credit Agricole sort of got out of equities business altogether. I mean, Germany says Deutsche Bank is going to continue maybe in Europe, but still not being in the U.S., that's really going to hurt their investment banking even further. So it doesn't look like a very great, amazing way out.
The analyst reaction was really unimpressed also. I mean, Deutsche Bank, Sakjian said that Deutsche Bank's plan's not aggressive enough. You also have CMC Markets saying that they're well behind the curve. RBC saying that a bad bank's not going to do anything to re-rate the company. I mean, if doing what they need to do isn't good enough, but then doing something that's good enough would destroy the company, like, what is the answer?
I mean, you know, we can talk about bad bank, but first the answer of why is it not aggressive enough? Because every analyst report that I've ever read in the last, 2 years now, is basically they need to cut costs. They have too much cost, and it's not only really getting out of businesses. It's really They have too many people in the back office. They have too many people doing things. Their technology is out of date. So they can do the businesses with fewer people, and the bank has constantly announced job cuts, which they cannot deliver. I mean, and I've written this many times over the last 2 or 3 years, is that they keep setting targets for reduction of staff levels, and they can never hit those targets. Every other bank in the world, you know, in their peers, everybody cut a long time ago and pretty quick. Even if it took a little longer for some of the European banks because they have tougher, you know, labor laws, still they've done it. I mean, Deutsche Bank has really been bad reducing staff, and thus they cannot make a profit. So getting rid of a business like equities, but you're also cutting the revenue. Instead, if you manage to cut the cost of that business and continue to get the revenue, then you would actually start making profit on it. But that's where they have really lacked, and that's what analysts keep constantly saying, that they need to cut the slack in their employee levels.
Well, Yaman, it was also reported this morning that Deutsche Bank would consider putting a lot of their troubled assets into a bad bank. What are those assets?
I mean, it's really interesting at this stage because, you know, we had bad banks after the 2008 crisis. And then, you know, Deutsche Bank and a couple other Europeans also did them after the European sovereign debt crisis. These were legacy things that, you know, were really no longer good. They sort of, you know, they were all written down, but to just sort of separate them from the main core business and show the investors, you know, what really was the core business was making as profit and revenue. But at this stage, banks don't have them. So I'm not sure what Deutsche is going to put in there. Level three assets, which is sort of hard to value things that they sort of have to use their internal models to value. That means they're not liquid. That's one place. But even there, they only had 25 billion euros of level three assets the last time I looked. That was the first quarter of this year. They're talking about 50 billion. I don't know where they're going to come up with, you know, derivatives, more derivatives that need to be put right there. The issue is, and I was reading an analyst wrote just before you called in, is you know, if these things are not losing money, then it doesn't matter whether they're on a bad bank, good bank, it doesn't matter what it's called.
Yep.
If they're actually losing money and there's still more write-down to be made, then that's tough because right, Deutsche doesn't have extra capital to take those write-downs. So I don't know what they mean, how they're going to really do the bad bank work.
Interesting. Yaman Onaran, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.